I think we were on section Roman numeral 4.2 in the class and gender outline. Just to remind you kind of where we are in this, in our tracking of these topics. Last time we began the class and gender discussion, reviewing this broad question of the difference between Marxism and feminism as two emancipatory social science theoretical perspectives anchored in different forms of oppression, facing different kinds of theoretical challenges. And specifically, I was focusing on the difference between Marxism, which in its efforts to understand the conditions for class emancipation is forced to worry about macro-institutional system-level problems of reproduction, which is why the problem of socialism has always been a fraught and difficult one for Marxian theory. It has to grapple with how do you organize an entire system and make it so reproducible. Whereas feminism as a theoretical perspective directed, an emancipatory theory directed towards the problem of emancipation around gender oppression, in a kind of global sense, talking about the emancipation of women, but it's really about the transformation of gender and the elimination of oppressions linked to that relationship, has tended to give very little attention to macro system level problems. The energy is focused primarily around the critique of male domination and its various forms. And the implicit argument is that it's enough to struggle against that, to reduce those forms of male domination, and that will be sufficient to open up the space for an emancipated set of relations, as if there is no system-level coordination macro problem. I didn't say in the talk, but in the lecture, that then underwrites another difference in these theoretical traditions, namely, feminist theory tends to have what some theorists would call a more voluntaristic character to it, and Marxism a more deterministic character. I regard the determinism of Marxism as an effort to solve a theoretical problem, not a satisfactory solution in many ways, but an effort to solve a theoretical problem, namely this very difficult problem of how to imagine a viable, reproducible macro system. Well, if you can make an argument that's essentially deterministic about the inevitability of such a solution, you can spend less energy trying to actually elaborate the solution. Whereas feminism, not needing to deal with such a theoretical problem, was free to be a more agency-centered or voluntaristic kind of social theory. All right, well, that was the introductory stuff that sort of set the stage. Then we turn to this much more concrete problem of how to understand the interactions of class and gender, involving both micro and macro issues, and understanding the interrelation. The first set of questions we looked at was the effects of gender on class. That's the less familiar problem. The effects of class on gender in the Marxian tradition has certainly been the more standard problem. The effects of gender on class. We distinguished two different ways in which we can think of the effects of gender on class. The first had to do with the nature of how people are connected to the class structure. That's an aspect of the complexity of the positions themselves, where mediated class locations was one of the key examples of that. That's the nature of the class locations, shaping the way people are tied to the class structure had to do with how people are sorted into class positions, and shaping the nature of the class locations themselves has to do with how certain kinds of positions get built in gendered, class positions get built in gendered ways. Okay, the next set of problems was the effects of class on gender. And that's, I think, where we cut off. The first issue I think we need to deal with here has to do with functional explanations again. We've discussed this a little bit already. We'll be encountering functional explanations many times in our discussions of the state and ideology, and in our discussions of race, which will be next week. Functional explanations of the relationship between class and gender. Here, I think I want to emphasize a contrast between two closely allied types of explanations, two kinds of explanations which masquerade as each other, but which are really different in important ways. This is the distinction between a functional explanation and an interest explanation. A functional explanation and an interest explanation. So in the class and gender case, a functional explanation has the form. Patriarchy takes the forms it does because this is good for capitalism. Why does male domination take the form of the family wage and women confined to full-time housework? Because that is the form of gender relations best suitable to reproduce the relations of production. It's good for capitalism. You explain a form, a structure, by its beneficial effects for something else, in this case, capitalism. That would be a functional explanation of gender by the class structure. Frederick Engels, in his famous essay, The Origins of the Family, State, and Private Property, argues that male domination arises because it's functional for the reproduction of private property. His functionalist explanation, which is a kind of pseudo-historical explanation, I mean, it's pseudo because he doesn't actually have any historical data to support it, but he relied on some anthropological data that he interpreted as historical. Anthropological data about North American, Native American communities then treated as if it were historical data about the primordial past of humanity in general. But his functional explanation had the following character. In order to have a stable system of private property, you have to have a stable system of inheritance of private property. In order to have a stable system of inheritance of private property, men have to know who their children are. The only way men can know who, women know who their children are, they have concrete empirical evidence. Men can only know who their children are if they control the fertility of women. It's the only way, because for obvious reasons. Male domination is a solution to a problem of reproducing private property. If men, in the first instance, have special access to the most valuable forms of property, because otherwise they wouldn't have this incentive problem of how to reproduce their property relations. And that's because men controlled large animals in animal husbandry. So in Engels' view, it's large animal husbandry which is the key. It's the domestication of large animals, and men control the large animals. And that's to be explained by a pre-patriarchal division of labor between men and women that was based on constraints of such things as lactation and early infant, the tending of early infants, and the division between hunters and gatherers. You know, there's a variety of reasons that were unconnected to domination that created a sexual division of labor in pre-class societies. Once animals get domesticated, then they get inherited. Men have special relations to large animals, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a functional account of male domination by the functions it serves for private property. That's a functionalist. Now, an interest argument says the reason why certain forms of male domination exist is because men have an interest in seeing that it exists. Or the reason why certain forms of male domination exists is because capitalists have interests in that form of male domination, and they see to it that that form of male domination persists. It's not that it's functionally explained by its role in a social system of feedbacks and interactions. It's because there are actors who see these structures as good for them, and they act in ways to preserve the structures that are good for them. Now, that's a much more simple, straightforward explanation. You know, it's similar to questions around the state. Why does the state have policies that are good for capitalists? Well, damn it, capitalists see to it that those policies are good for them, and policies which are not, they oppose and they prevent from happening. It's their interests and their ability to act on their interests because they're powerful. A lot of conspiracy theories, you know, things that happen behind the scenes because you can't actually see these interests being played out, have that character. So you see why functional explanations and interest explanations kind of mush together sometimes, right? Capitalists see that certain structures exist because they see that those structures are good for them, and they have the power to ensure that their interests get turned into structures. Or these structures exist because they're good for capitalism, regardless of what capitalists think. You know, they could muck it up because they could act in ways that actually prevent things which are good for them. Sort of in spite of whatever capitalists think, these are the structures that are good for capitalism. And then there's some process of selection, trial and error, mucking about until you get a stable equilibrium in which, on average, you end up with the structures which are compatible and good for capitalism. The difference between a functional explanation and an interest explanation, so here's the thing to remember, the difference in the structure of the explanation is that an interest explanation always is based on some actor or group of actors seeing to it that something happens because they believe it to be good for them. They're acting on the basis of anticipated effects. Right? So it has to work through intentions of actors. It has to be based on what they believe would be good for them, not what's actually good for them. Functional explanations make arguments in terms of what's actually beneficial, not what the actors anticipate to be beneficial. Yeah?
So how does it differ from the intentional explanation?
Right, so it's an intentional, interest explanations and intentional explanations go together. The difference is that intentional explanations people may not act on their interests on purpose. So a person can have as their intentions doing things that are good for others, not just in their own interests. So interest explanations are a subset of intentional explanations. An interest explanation says, these policies exist, these structures exist, male domination exists because it's in the interests of capitalists and they know it and they see to it. Or it's in the interests of men and they know it and they exert agency to reproduce and ensure this. A functional explanation says these structures exist because they actually produce effects which are beneficial. And they persist because that fact, that they're beneficial, sets in motion a kind of equilibrium. It creates a stable fitting together of different parts of a system that work sufficiently in harmony to constitute a system of reproduction. When we get to the theory of the state, well, that's where really these issues become kind of crystallized in the clearest way. My view is that both interest and functional explanations are valid. There's no a priori reason to reject one or the other. And that often they work in tandem. That is, powerful actors act in their interest to create policies and structures which they think are good for them. They're often idiots and make mistakes and do the wrong thing. When they are, they don't end up with stable solutions. That the system stabilizes or crystallizes, that's sometimes the term that's used, into a equilibrium that is reproductive once they stumble upon a solution that does in fact generate stabilizing effects. And that fact doesn't depend upon their purposes. And that's how interest and functional explanations actually work in tandem rather than in opposition to each other. You can think of it, the simplest way to think of it is even to take a capitalist firm. Capitalist managers and firms are trying to maximize profits, but they may be pretty clueless as to what's the best way to do it. So they just keep trying things. It's trial and error. And they stop once they actually see that they're getting a satisfactory profit rate. That means that they stop at the point where there's an actual functional relationship between what they're doing and what's good for reproducing their relations. It's not natural selection in the Darwinian sense of something completely operating behind the backs of actors without any consciousness and purposes on their parts. The giraffe of the length of neck of the giraffe is functional for the sexual reproduction of the giraffe without the giraffe having any purposes in mind about lengthening its neck. So this would be as if you had giraffes who would kind of, through a trial and error process, keep trying to find a better way. This is sort of a Lamarckian view. They keep trying to have a better way to eat acacia leaves, and some giraffes stumble upon the longer neck version, and that actually does the job, so they stop looking for a better way to do it. That combines purposes as being part of the generative force of the experiments that eventually lead to a stabilization and an equilibrium. So that's how interest and function work together. All right, well, this was all general stuff. To get back to the gender question, functional explanations and interest explanations are often present in discussions of gender oppression and their connection to capital, to class oppression. Male domination in contemporary society is explained by virtue of the positive effects it has for capitalists or capitalism. Those would be capitalist interest and capitalist functional explanations. Or the class interest version would be male domination in contemporary society is explained because capitalists realize that it is in their interest to see to it that male domination continues. And again, I think you can find instances in the history of the gender class connection and its transformation where both interest and functional explanation seem to be in play. In the lecture notes, which will be online, I go through Engels' specific functional argument, which I won't do in a more refined way here. A functional argument of contemporary Marxist feminists as well. Let me just briefly mention the Marxist feminist version, which is a common one that you see. It's not so common anymore, but it was certainly when Marxist feminism was itself a central perspective within feminism. The argument among Marxist feminists is typically the following, that the provision of unpaid domestic services is beneficial for capitalism because it lowers the cost of reproducing labor power. That is, it's cheaper for capitalists to provide wages for workers. Wages are lower because workers do not have to buy all of their conditions of reproduction on the market. Some of those conditions are provided free through free services provided by wives. And that's only possible because of male domination, that you'll have this vast amount of free labor provided for wives. In that view, the labor provided to reproduce male labor power in the home is actually being exploited by capitalists indirectly, because capitalists are able to lower the value of labor power, that is the wages they have to pay, because part of the cost of reproducing labor power is being provided free. And that means that the rate of exploitation of husbands includes the appropriation of this free labor provided by wives. Right, so that's the domestic labor view. There'd be three ways in which these free labor, this free labor in the home could be provided. It could be divided equally between husbands and wives. It could be provided mainly by women or mainly by men. The Marxist feminist argument is that the solution to how do we get all this free services provided in the home, that the reason, the historic reason for the solution being that women will provide the labor, had to do with historically the problem, the cost problem involved with raising small children. Particularly because this is the argument that Maria Ramos and Johanna Brenner make in a very good article written in the, I believe in the early 1980s around the domestic labor debate. So they argued that there was this constraint on the possibility of reproducing the working class household caused by high infant mortality and a high infant mortality, high fertility regime in order for working class households to have assurance that there'd be some adult children alive and working to provide support for aging working class families, parents. So because of high infant mortality, strategies needed to be adopted within the family to provide for the reproduction of children. And it was rational for everyone in the family, both husbands and wives, that women specialize in household work under these conditions, that the total welfare of all members of the household would be increased if it was possible to achieve a situation where men would be the sole breadwinner and women would provide all the domestic labor, as opposed to a system where you divided the domestic labor equally, or even more if men were to do the domestic labor and women were to be the full-time workers. So in the 19th century, the struggle over the family wage was a struggle over the survival of the family, not a struggle for male domination. But it then created a set of structural relations which deepened the subordination of women and created the forms of patriarchy that then were the challenge for transformation later in the 20th century. This system stabilized because it was efficient for capitalism. Right? So it's a combination of the interests of families, knowing what's good for them. So you have an interest part of the explanation on the struggle of working class families to get a family wage, and a functional relationship that this stabilizes because it's actually good for capitalism as well. Okay, that's the 2.1 under Roman numeral 4, functional explanations and interest explanations. That's one of the ways of thinking about the connection of the effects of class on gender, the effects of class on gender. In this domestic labor story, the effects of class on gender are the working class family is in a particular class position with particular vulnerabilities. They have a problem to solve. They have to solve it in articulation to the capitalist conditions of reproduction of class relations. So you've got these two intersecting problems. And that gets stabilized in a particular gender regime of the male breadwinner model, which then deepens the subordination of women and persists even after it no longer is needed for these functional reasons. And then it gets transformed in the context of struggles and transformations and new conditions, particularly after the middle of the 20th century. The second way in which class and gender are interconnected in the form that class has effects on gender has to do with the ways in which class structures may obstruct changes in gender relations or in other forms of oppression, even if they're not functional for reproducing class structures. So class structures can be an obstacle to changing something, even if it isn't functional for capitalism. And that's for two kinds of reasons. One is, class structures shape the resources available for struggles. And because of the way in which class allocates resources to actors, it may be difficult to transform gender relations, even if the untransformed relations are not beneficial for capitalism. Class structures affect access to resources, and this affects struggles over gender oppressions. So, for example, it may be that the way in which the necessary condition for really radically transforming the gender relations in the home is the provision of good quality, accessible daycare for young children. Because it could be the case, I think there's good reasons to believe this, that one of the mechanisms which makes male domination and inequalities between men and women a persistent problem is because of this question of the care of infant and young children and how the division of labor around that and the responsibilities around that are to be done. To the extent that inexpensive, good quality childcare services are available, publicly available, in the environment of households, that makes it easier for people to struggle at the micro level over that division of labor. That division of labor becomes easier to struggle toward and to move towards an egalitarian division when there is a publicly provided, accessible, good quality system of daycare. When there isn't, when the responsibilities for childcare are entirely on the household, the struggle for equality within households becomes harder. Now, capitalism can obstruct the creation of that kind of system of daycare, not because capitalists have interests or capitalism has a functional need for women to be subordinated in the household and take full responsibility for that, but because capitalists don't want to, and it's difficult for capitalism to allocate adequate resources for that. There's a resource constraint on the solution to that problem created by the fact that it won't be profitable. It'll be a subtraction from accumulation. It'll be a redistribution from capital accumulation to what could be called social accumulation. To fund those daycare centers, you need higher taxes and you need redistribution of the surplus from its availability for capital accumulation to its availability to solve problems of needs, in this case, the need for childcare services. Capitalism can obstruct access to those resources and therefore be an obstacle to the transformation of the gender relations without it also being the case that keeping childcare services in the home provided by women, that itself is good for capitalism. Capitalism is indifferent to that capitalism could thrive with or without, at this point in history, with or without women providing these services in the home or taking the major responsibility. But it's too costly to solve the problem. Now, you see why that's a very different kind of argument. You don't have to then make any kind of functional argument with respect to the gender problem per se. The functional argument is entirely around the costs to capital accumulation of having a bigger public sector with a bigger part of the economy oriented towards the meeting of human needs as opposed to the maximizing of profit. Now, an alternative solution, of course, would be to have profit-making firms provide daycare services. The problem with that is, universally, that it doesn't provide adequate daycare services at an affordable cost for most people. So for-profit daycare centers are indeed a solution to this problem, as is privately provided in-house daycare services with nannies for people who are wealthy, but it does not provide adequate daycare services for the masses of ordinary families. The market can't provide that. It's too costly to provide good quality daycare, particularly for very young children. You know, after school programs is a different matter, but daycare for infants and small children is a very costly thing to do well. It has to be a social collective responsibility. Capitalism blocks that. It's not that it has a functional need for the current system. Yeah?
I'm thinking of Wisconsin when workfare became when work fair was implemented, because I thought that what they started to do was implement kind of this quasi-public daycare, where the state would subsidize part of daycare, and the mother would have to pay for the rest of it, because you could argue that that capitalism needed more people in these service sector positions, kicking people off of doles and putting them into these jobs.
Right. So that's when I say that capitalism is an obstacle to this, I don't mean it's an obstacle that can't ever be overcome. Mm-hmm. Quebec, for example, has a very good, high-quality daycare system that costs $7 a day for full-time daycare to parents from infants on, for full-time daycare. And they have small daycare centers all over the place. These are community-based, small centres pour les petits enfants, centers for little children. And it's publicly subsidized. Parents pay $7 a day. The province, I think, pays $35 a day. So that entry-level child care providers, daycare workers, earn $30,000 a year. That's the entry-level salary, which is about 2.5 times the entry-level salary of full-time daycare workers in the U.S. But that's provided by public funds, mm-hmm. right? And it's expensive. And the right wing is opposed to it. And it's in jeopardy now because of the economic crisis. So in the case of the Wisconsin thing, there was a view of a trade-off, that we had welfare payments that were expensive. And the idea was, if you could force women into the labor force, you could have cheaper child care services that would be just subsidized but not fully paid. And then you'd get rid of the welfare payments. So the calculus was, overall, that was a cheaper equilibrium. Still, cost saving was the major motivation. It was then legitimated on the grounds of it being part of a moral reconstruction, reform of the poor by making them responsible. It was the Personal Responsibility Act. That was the rhetoric of the whole welfare reform. But it was essentially thought to be to create a more favorable equilibrium than having an expensive welfare system without any work requirements or childcare support, moving from one equilibrium to another.
And it was retrenched in the French part,
yeah.
Because it didn't work.
Right. There were some progressive aspects of that reform. It wasn't all bad. The childcare provisions were actually a step forward, not an adequate one, but it was certainly a step forward. But it was a vulnerable step, because then when austerity occurs, you always cut from programs for the poor. So class structures can obstruct change, even if there's no functionality involved, because of the issue of resources. And then the third aspect of the problem of the relationship of class and gender and the effects of class on gender concerns what can be called the dynamic asymmetry of class and gender. Dynamic asymmetry. And then this is an interesting theoretical problem. Is there really a case for a dynamic primacy of class? And what do I mean by dynamic in this case? If we look at the question of the reciprocal effects of class on gender and gender on class dynamically, that is, how they evolve over time, then it is possible to make a case that within capitalism, changes in the class structure have had a bigger effect on changes in gender relations than vice versa. The question here is this: why have gender relations so dramatically changed in the last half century? So there's no question, there's been a dramatic transformation of gender relations in the last half century. The expectations of young women today as to what kinds of careers they want to have, how they want to integrate family with their lives, what the role of their role will be with respect to children and housework, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those expectations are just dramatically different than they were in 1960. And the reality has changed. It's not just a question of expectations. It's not just a question of sort of identities and people's goals. If you look at every indicator of inequality, including some of the more intractable ones, like inequality within heterosexual households in the division of labor over various household tasks. So which household task would you say remains the most inegalitarian? You know, in the standard list of things that people have to deal with in the house. So the standard list are taking care of children in non-recreational taking care, not playing, but, you know, routine tending of children, cooking, cleaning up the house, shopping, and laundry. Let's take those five. Those are the kind of big five that usually, and then there's yard work, there's outdoor stuff. There's six, let's say. So which remains the most gender inegalitarian of those?
Laundry.
Laundry. Laundry is the one that has budged the least. Childcare has actually budged quite a lot. There's been a very big change, including, and you have to distinguish between recreational childcare and non-recreational childcare. You know, the parts of childcare that have to do with, you know, playing catch in the backyard is different than the childcare that has to do with bathing and dressing and baby tending and homework. I mean, homework is an ambiguous case, whether how much recreation and how much non-recreation is involved. Depends upon the kid and the parent and the topic, I suppose, and the assignment. So there's been on all of these things, even on laundry, there's been a change. It's just the current, just so you know, the current theories about, one of the theories around this is what's referred to as the game of chicken, right? So that you've got, the game of chicken is the game where you have sort of a 1950s myth. You'd have guys out on a country road driving cars at each other at full speed, and the question is who flinches and leaves the road, and that's the chicken, the person who refuses. So the one way to win the game of chicken is to lock your steering wheel and to show the person that you just have no control over your car, right? You know, then. But of course, if both cars do that, then you're really in trouble. So in households, it's basically what happens with laundry. It's often described as a game of chicken, that the men simply refuse to do it at the standard that the women want it done. And so then the question is the woman prepared to lower standards, which I think is mostly around folding and ironing, not right. So these are not such difficult skills to acquire, but in any case, so why has this changed so much? So the most obvious kind of thread of argument is that there's been a massive entry of women into the labor force, which is a change in their relationship to the class structure. This is driven by the dynamics of capitalism, which creates needs for a different kind of labor force, and there was this untapped labor supply in domestic labor and housewives who were educated, literate, and the needs for a literate labor force expanded dramatically after the Second World War. It was an untapped labor supply. Because of gender inequalities in labor markets, it was a cheap labor supply, so that employers could play off of the background conditions of gender inequality to actually get labor for the expanding clerical and service sector less expensively than if they did it by improving the educational standards for men overall. And this led to entry of women into the labor force, which changed the gender dynamics in the household. Women began to have exit options that they didn't have before. They had improved bargaining position within the household. They had career opportunities that were obstructed and they objected to, etc. So while it's certainly true that struggles around gender, the women's movement, were crucial to unbottling some of the bottlenecks in this process, the dynamic force which pushed it forward and made that possible had to do with exogenous, in a way, changes in the class structure. That's where there was a dynamic. And that dynamic was itself independent of gender. That had to do with the changes in the forces of production, the patterns of globalization, the nature of investment portfolios, you know, all this stuff that goes together with generating constant dynamic change in capitalist relations. One might therefore say the following, that you can explain why across Western European and other developed capitalist countries, why the rate of change of gender relations varies, has to do with the nature of gender and its institutionalization, but the fact that they all change in the same direction is not because of any property specific to gender, it's because of the dynamic force of capitalist development. So that there is, therefore, a kind of causal asymmetry in the explanations for the transformation of gender, even if there's no primacy of class with respect to gender in any static sense. It's not that in the lives of people at any given point in time, class matters more for their life than gender. Indeed, I would say one could easily, you know, it's a perfectly reasonable claim that in general for most people their identities are more bound up with gender than class, and their sense of possibility and who they are and what they want is more structured deeply by gender than class, even if it's the case that class explains the transformations more than gender. So that there's a disjuncture between the static impact of these two sets of relations in which all of our lives are embedded and the dynamic problem of how do we understand the process of transformations. Now, I'm saying that that's a plausible set of arguments. It's not a rock-solid set of arguments. And I, you know, we can discuss, and it's something you can write about if any of you are interested for your next paper. It's a good kind of meaty theme to kind of wrestle with. The same thing applies, by the way, to race, and this is something which I'll mention briefly in the race discussion, which we'll have on next week. If you want to ask the question, why did the civil rights movement succeed in the 1950s and 60s, but fail in the 20s and 10s and 30s? So if you look at the whole period from the end of the Civil War, from Reconstruction, the 100 years from 1870 to 1970, and you ask the question, why did the final eradication of all legal forms, so just talking about that aspect, legal forms of discrimination based on race, why was that finally smashed definitively in the 50s and 60s, culminating in the Civil Rights Act of the 60s? And why is it that now there is no prospect whatsoever, not even a thin one, of there ever being in any current imaginable future, a reinstigation of racially explicit differential citizenship rights? You know, that's just off the historical agenda now. It's not going to happen. Not that there won't be discrimination, not that there's all sorts of informal forms of racial discrimination, but it is not the case that we're going to have a law instituted that says people of African descent in the United States now have to use bathrooms in the back of the and sit at the back of the bus. That's not on the historic. That's not historically possible. Why did it happen in the 50s and 60s? Well, as I will argue when we do that, I think the central argument is that the nature of the economic structures which underwrote racism had fundamentally changed in the South by the 1960s. And that form of racism, that very sharp legalized subordination of blacks, was no longer functionally needed for the reproduction of Southern capitalism. But it had been in the 1870s to 1930s. It had declined dramatically. That functionality eroded dramatically in the 30s and 40s. It was basically gone by the 50s. And it then took massive struggles to actually dismantle the machinery. But it was dismantleable because of endogenous changes in the class structure. So it's not that there are... It's not, again, that in the lives of people, class mattered more than race. It may have, it may not have. That will vary. But the dynamic asymmetry between the two gives a class explanation of the race transformation have some claims to primacy. And again, that's not a rock-solid argument. There are arguments against it. Yeah. Right.
Because implicitly, I think a lot of voter ID laws right now seem to definitely have racial motivation.
So the right. So I think the photo ID laws are more class motivated, and it's even narrower than that. It's more motivated by the likely voters for progressive policies. Period. Because it's directed against students as well.
Right. But, okay. So then it just.
Right. And there may be some racial motivations as well. And, you know, I'm not saying that that has completely disappeared from the motivations, but they could not have a law that said that African Americans have to have a photo ID and nobody else. That, you know, you could not have a law like that. And I don't mean just because the Supreme Court would knock it down. It's that there would be protests against that would dwarf what we saw last spring, right? I mean, you'd get hundreds of thousands of people out everywhere in the state if you had something like that done. And the same thing would really be true for, you know, for some gender explicit discrimination. You know, the last vestiges of legalized gender discrimination are just hanging on by a thread. Such as women in combat. I mean, even that has basically, it's come very close to disappearing. Not quite, apparently, in certain codes, but, you know, there's basically, people cannot defend legalized discrimination any longer, I think. The immigration issue is a special case of it, of course, and it does have a racial... No question about it. It has a racial face to it, but I think it's a very different kind of problem. Okay. Roman numeral 5. The joint effects of class and gender in explaining various things. So suppose we want to explain some variation across individuals. This is the standard sort of thing that sociologists do. You want to explain the gender gap in voting, right? So there have been some periods where women have been more conservative on average than men, some periods where there's not much difference, some periods where women have been, and this has been the more recent past, have been more liberal on standard American voting kind of measures. It's always the case that one should never have a sentence of the form "women are more liberal than men." There's no such actor called women. It's that the distribution of political views among women and men are different, and these distributions have different medians or different modes, mode being the most frequent. So you could say the modal woman or the median woman is more liberal than the median man. That's a better way of thinking about it even than average, because the median is the midpoint of a distribution. It's a real position. The average isn't, because if you have some big skew on something, the average can be very misleading. It doesn't mean typical. Normally, when people just casually think about this, they mean the average person in the sense of the typical person. They don't mean the person who's the average of some distribution. They mean the typical person. And median captures that pretty well. Mode under certain kinds of distributions does as well. So there's a gap. And you might want to explain that. Why is it that women are more liberal than men on average? typically, modally, etc. Well, this is an example of where you would want to look at the joint effects of class and gender in explaining something. The way to think about it is, I think, that there are two distinct mechanisms in play. I call that the distinct mechanisms thesis. This seems kind of trivial to say, but I think it's important to affirm. When we speak of class and gender as forms of oppression, we are identifying distinct causal mechanisms, things that exist in the world independently of our theories, which we discover and theorize through our observations and theoretical work. That's what social science does. They're the names for these causal mechanisms, or clusters of mechanisms. So, you know, a term like class covers a lot of stuff, as we know, when you're using it to explain something. So when you say that class is one of the determinants of political positions and voting, typically what one means is one's income and wealth and position in the job structure and the authority structure. That cluster of things together shape the lived experiences and interests of actors in ways that affects their voting. And I think that's the proper way of understanding it, class as a clustering of mechanisms under a general rubric. But it's still real mechanisms that we're talking about, and that they are distinct from gender. Now, distinct doesn't mean that these mechanisms operate independently of each other. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're living your life and you got some class effects, and then you have some gender effects, and that these are completely unconnected to each other. Distinct just means that the causal processes have distinct characteristics to them. They always occur through interactions. And that's the second thesis, what could be called the interaction effects thesis. And if you want a bumper sticker for the for this interaction effects thesis, the bumper sticker is "the world is not additive." Right, so that's a good sociological bumper sticker. Maybe a little obscure, but nevertheless, it's a good thing. The world is not additive. What the world is not additive means, what that means is that the effects of class on your voting may depend upon your gender, and the effects of gender on your voting may depend in part on your class, as opposed to there's a gender effect and a class effect. So it may be that among wealthy people, gender has no effect, but among poor people, it has a big effect, for example. Or it could be the other way around, that among men, class has a much smaller effect than among women, where class could have a bigger effect. Interactions are complicated things to sort out, and it's a real challenge in empirical research to really, really nail the nuances of this. In a formal equation, I think I mentioned this in some earlier lecture, in a formal equation, this means that if you're explaining the gender gap in voting for Republicans and or Democrats, let's say, the political voting gap by gender, what one would say is that the voting gap is a function of a class effect, a gender effect, and an interaction effect. So as an equation, it's voting equals B1 times class plus B2 times gender plus B3 times class by gender. That's the interaction effect. If you're a quantitatively oriented sociologist and you want to have a splash, you know, one way to make a splash in the discipline is to show that there's an interaction effect that people have been ignoring. You know, to show that people have been studying something as if the world was additive, you show that there's an interaction in there. What interaction effects do is it takes some of the effects which had been packed into the additive terms and shows that actually they're not additive. It comes from the joint effect. So you kind of reduce the, it always has the effect when you add an additive term. It always, if there is an interaction, when you add an interaction term, it always has the effect of reducing the magnitudes of B1 and B2 and packing some of those effects into the interactive term. There are interesting other cases. There are special cases in which once you do an interaction, one of those two additive effects could actually increase if the particular nature of the equations were such that what the interaction is doing is dramatically reducing the effects of one of those two variables and showing the other one actually might have a bigger additive. In any case, the world is, there are distinct mechanisms and there are interaction effects. Those are the two ways to think through the problem of the joint effects of class and gender. The claim that, as I mentioned earlier, the claim that all there is interaction is the claim that those additive terms are always zero, that all of the causal effects come through the interaction of class and gender. If that's really true, then as I said, I think you have to get rid of the additive terms. They don't belong in the equation. You've just demonstrated that we thought there were additive effects and there's not, and you should replace the concept of class with the concept of gender. All right. One more little topic. We've already talked about this, so I actually think the best thing is to, I'll just mention it, but I'm not going to go through the Goldthorpe debate around all this in any detail. I think it's very clearly laid out in the chapter that was assigned, and then we could begin the race discussion after the break. But the basic idea here is if you take a list of occupations of husbands and wives. So this problem kicks in households where there are two wage earners, two people in the labor force. And the question is, how do we understand the class location, especially the class location of women? That's where the debate was over. So you have a wife who's a full-time typist and her husband is a factory worker, and a wife who's a full-time typist or secretary or clerical worker, and her husband is a capitalist. So what's the class of the woman in these two cases? And there's many other cases you can imagine, of course. How should we think about the class of the wife, of women who are in the same occupation themselves, same class position in terms of their own jobs, but married to men in very different class positions? Goldthorpe's view is you should assign them the class of their husbands. The reasoning is pretty straightforward, that families pool their income, which is pretty true. There's some asymmetries in how resources are allocated, but contemporary families are pretty much consumption units with pooled income. There is this kind of traditional household where the man controls the purse strings, but that's not actually descriptive of many, many families where wives actually, even if they earn less, manage the household budget in a way that husbands don't. Yeah?
I'm not certain why the distinction is specifically on women. Why would that be that we would consider the class status of the household based on the breadwinner of the family? Because there are certainly families where women are earning more income.
Right. So a modernized version of Goldthorpe's view would be to just call it the breadwinner model, and it could be whoever the breadwinner was. At the time he was writing in the early 80s, overwhelmingly breadwinners were men. The spirit of his argument is a breadwinner model. So it was a kind of shorthand, an unnecessarily irritating one. Goldthorpe could have written, it's a worthwhile paper to read. I don't remember if I assigned it or not, but it's definitely worthwhile. Any interested, it's worth reading. It's an example of a paper which could have been written as a radical feminist paper, but he chose to write it as an anti-feminist paper in which all of the substance could have been said. So he could have written the paper saying, it's a hallmark of systems of male domination that the class character of households is overwhelmingly shaped by that of men. And this is one of the sources of indictment of male domination, right? And he does sort of say that in the actual text, but instead he writes it as an attack on feminists who feel that women, because the feminist position that the class of women should be identified with their own jobs. It really is a breadwinner model. Now, the claim of the breadwinner model in Goldthorpe's version is really that the household fully subordinates its collective strategies to the dominant wage earner. Now, if that were true, if it were really the case that all decisions of households around, in which there were choices to be made, around the interests connected to the breadwinner's job versus any other source of income, if it always had the case that there was a strategic choices made exclusively on the breadwinner's job rather than on the combination, then I think it would be a reasonable thing to say that for most purposes the class of the household is homogenized around the breadwinner's class, and that other people's classes just don't figure into the calculation of interests of anybody in the household. I think there's two things that are wrong about that, however, that are just sort of pretty fundamentally flawed. One is that class interests are not only derived from the question of the income generated by your class position, and therefore they're not just consumption-centered interests. People have class interests rooted in their lived experience on the jobs. They have solidarities with their fellow employees and workers. And that also is generative of interests, so that it could well be that even if the household, in its household strategies, fully subordinates all choices to the choices that maximize the family's interest with respect to the breadwinner's job, it could still be the case that a woman who's a factory worker married to a manager, you know, will have interests bound up with her solidarities with her co-workers, and that could create big strains and big stresses and forms of conflict within the family by virtue of how you deal with a strike, for example. So lived experience is a relevant aspect of understanding class position, and those are generated in work as well as in consumption. So the first criticism of Goldthorpe's is that it's a purely consumption-centered notion of where the interests lie. The interests lie entirely from the income generated and the standard of living and material welfare of the household, and not from any of the practices and activities in work. And the second thing is, even aside from that, it's just not plausible that even where there's a clear breadwinner, that the strategies of families are entirely based on the strategies of the breadwinner's job, because the welfare of the family actually depends upon both jobs. So unless the breadwinner is earning 90% of the income and the non-breadwinner worker 10%, and, you know, if it's that unequal, then of course you give very little weight from the household's point of view. But the typical household, given the inequalities in the labor market, it's still the case that in the typical household, men earn more than women. But the ratios are, you know, 65-35, 60-40. They're not 90-10. And if it's 60-40, the strategies that affect the careers of the 40% of the household income earner matter quite a lot for the welfare of the household. So unless you're in a situation where there's a huge gain to be made for the higher earner, and therefore it should preempt any consideration for the lower earner, most families are going to try to juggle these. And it'll be hard and it'll be difficult, and the juggling is going to involve all sorts of things other than just the income aspect of it. No, so there's going to be all this complexity. And that complexity is not captured by simply saying everybody, that the class of the household is entirely the class of the breadwinner. So I propose then this more complex model, which says that everybody in a household has two kinds of class positions. They have their direct class position and their mediated class position. The mediated class position comes from the composition of the household as a whole. Their direct class position comes from their own class position. So all members of a household share the mediated class location. That's the combination of all the class interests in the stew of a household. So long as they are a solidaristic unit of consumption, sharing collective interests around the household's welfare, then they all share the same mediated realities, because that's the whole mix. But they have different individual classes, direct classes. And that complexity then is how we should understand these positions. Yeah?
Could you say then that everybody has a shadow class, not just everyone?
Right, so the shadow class is another aspect of this. The shadow class is what your class would be in the face of the dissolution of your household. The shadow class is a complicated matter to actually know, because it's a prediction. A person, for example, women may have a higher earning shadow class than their current direct class, because they may be taking a job that doesn't earn as much as they could earn because they live in a household where there's another source of income. So you can't just measure the shadow class of a woman by what her current job is. Her shadow class could be different. And the same, of course, would be true for men. Yeah, so that's the temporal aspect of household class formation. So sort of the last topic in the class in gender part of the story. I use that conceptualization, mediated class locations, as a way then of doing an empirical investigation of Sweden and the United States, and the central punchline of that empirical demonstration exploration was that Goldthorpe looks pretty good if you sort of test his predictions. His prediction is that all members of a household share the same class, and it's identical to the class of the husband. Whereas my argument was, the mediated class location argument is, no, that people have this complex combination of direct and mediated class, and therefore members of households don't have fully the same class. They do in some respects and not in others. I then predicted that a working class woman married to a middle class man would be different from a working class woman married to a middle class man in terms of their class positions, with respect to some of the things we think class explains. One of the things class explains is class identity. So one of the effects of class is, what class do you think you're in? And so I had this simple kind of comparison. I had a 2x2 table, the class of husband, the class of wife, and what we're trying to explain is class identity. And it turns out in the United States, if you know a woman's, this is 1980 data, may not be true now, if you know a married woman in two-earner households, so it's restricted to that, a married woman's husband's class, you get no improvement in your prediction of her class identity by also knowing her class. That is, her own class position adds nothing to the prediction of her class identity once you already know her husband's class. But in Sweden, that's not the case. In Sweden, knowing a woman's husband's class and adding her class to the equation, her class has about the same weight as her husband's class. It's also true for Swedish men that adding the wife's class adds to the prediction of his identity, but not as strongly. So the wife's class effect on husband's identity is weaker than the husband's class effect on the wife's identity, but they're both significant statistically in both cases. So my argument was then, well, how do we explain why Goldthorpe's theory, his concept works in the US but not in Sweden? And my answer was that in the United States, class identities are formed around consumption. We have a consumption-oriented process of consciousness formation, whereas in Sweden, because of the strength of unions and the organization of daily life on the shop floor, the formation of class identities within work, there are two processes through which class identities are formed, both within work itself and within consumption. So in a purely consumption-based process of class formation, which is the result of the histories of class struggle and the way in which ideologies get formed, then the Goldthorpe model, the breadwinner model, which in that in 1980 would be a male breadwinner model, works pretty well. Whereas in the Swedish case, where class formation occurs both within work and in consumption, the mediated class predictions work better. Okay, let's take our break, and that will end the gender lecture. We'll begin our discussion of race in class.